Hey, y'all, and welcome back to another episode of Project Good Food. This episode is special. Not that any of the other ones weren't, but this one is actually being filmed live at the Food System Alliance's annual gathering. That will keep things spicy. Let's get started. So good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's okay. You can participate in this. Good morning, everybody. Nice. Today on the podcast of Good Food, we're going to be discussing the rise of urban agriculture. I wanted to introduce Ms. Moss first because she is the foundation of Project New Village. Ms. Moss is a waymaker and womanist with over 30 years of experience managing small community-rooted organizations in southeastern San Diego. She was selected as 2019's Woman of the Year for the 79th State Assembly District and awarded the 2019 Trailblazer Award by the San Diego Voice and Viewpoint. She was recently the recipient of the 2024 Leaders in Belonging Award from the Priebus Foundation. And now for Dr. Derek Robinson, which is the University of California Cooperative Extension Advisor, focusing on urban agriculture, food systems, and environmental issues, and co-director of the Cooperative Extension in San Diego County. Dr. Robinson recently has served as Senior Research and Policy Analyst at the Center on Policy Initiatives. Good morning, and glad to have you both.
He's also a member of the board of directors for Project New Village.
Let's not bury any more leads, I guess.
And for the record, I asked Dr. Robinson if there was anything else that he wanted on his introduction. He failed to mention that he wanted the board seat on there.
It is on me. You did, and I did fail to mention it. But I am treasurer of the board of Project New Village, and I've been in that role for about 7 years now.
See there.
So yeah, it's been a great journey following the leadership of Ms. Moss.
I have to say that speaking to the leadership idea of Ms. Moss, it is hard to articulate how different it is working with somebody who is as intentional as Ms. Moss, right? And so learning about the nuance of language that Ms. Moss uses, there's words that I've now had to become accustomed to. For instance, how many people in this room have heard of the idea of a food desert? Almost everybody, if not everybody. Who in here has heard of the term food apartheid? Not nearly as many. So I would like to start this discussion and this podcast off with Ms. Moss, a question for you that is, what is food apartheid? What is food sovereignty? And how do those two phrases play a role in the work that you do?
Okay, I'm gonna just give you my, because you asked me in this context. So food apartheid to me is an intentional, I don't want to say displacement or intentional separation or non-equal distribution and food system in a space, right? That it's by no accident, it's by policies, it's by intention that some get and some don't get, and those that are most impacted are in communities of color most times. Food sovereignty to me is a fixer. It's a state where you're in control of what you eat, what you produce, right? It's where maybe convenience takes a backstage, and it's hard work and being in control of systems that bring your food to you. The production, the distribution, the consumption, the recycling, all of that is in your purview. It doesn't take any onus off of anyone else, but it makes the person who is benefiting at center stage in terms of what is distributed and eaten in a space.
And Dr. Robinson, you actually did just speak to this, but my first question for you is, what is your connection with Project New Village? How were you introduced to this work? And what is the role that you currently play?
Excuse me. Thank you for that question. Again, I sit on the board of Project New Village. I was invited to be a part of the mission and values and vision that Project New Village is implementing within Southeastern San Diego by our previous chair, Mr. Kamal Martin. Me and him were both part of a cohort called Rockwood Leadership Institute, where our responsibility and the reason that we were being brought together was to increase health and racial equity within the San Diego region. So within that lens, we both started talking, and I'm coming from a food background. My grandfather was a sharecropper in southwestern Georgia who used his connections and different types of ideas of the way he was moving food around to move his family to Atlanta, which is where I'm from originally. I stayed with that connection just because he was a farmer in Atlanta in an urban setting and like something that was a quarter of an acre of a lot. That led me to continue down that pathway as I went on into my academic career. I graduated from the University of North Florida in Jacksonville. Upon graduating, I worked for this place called the Environmental Center. I was able to get access to seed grant funding to start an urban agriculture project at a transitional living facility that was specifically focusing in on veterans and getting veterans to transition back into being able to find places to live. They had a culinary arts training program there. And so I wanted those people who were participating in that training program to be connected to the food that they were making. And so we decided to be able to try to put a garden there. That garden turned into, after a couple of years, a donation of a 14-acre land allotment within Jacksonville. And then following that, I decided that I would go into continuing my academic career in graduate school. I pursued a PhD in applied economics through an agricultural economics and rural sociology program at Auburn University. And there I got to connect with several coastal communities. I was a marine resources fellow with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, doing coastal resource assessments, trying to understand resiliency in communities. And then post graduating, I moved out here to San Diego, where I got a job with University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources. I was doing financial literacy programming, but I really wanted to get back into the food element. Kamal introduced me to Ms. Moss, and Ms. Moss, with her connections to the community, really excited me about what I could do here within the San Diego region. She connected me with so many different people, people who are also now have moved on, Mr. Tambuzzi, Mr. Hernandez, folks who also sat on the board with me and provided me with leadership and helped me to see the vision that Project New Village has around creating this food sovereignty movement. I've been involved in policy space where I was working on economic justice issues, and now I have let all that aggregate me to this position I am with now, where I'm the Urban Agriculture, Food Systems, and Environmental Issues Advisor for University of California Cooperative Extension. And it's a great piece to be able to take these institutional structural resources to be able to move them into our community to help increase the amount of food sovereignty that we all collectively can have. So yes, that's my connection.
So yeah, absolutely. So congratulations on that new position. From what I understand, that position did not exist prior to you taking it on. Is that correct?
It hadn't existed in quite some time. The last advisor who had concentrated on urban agriculture retired sometime in the early to mid 2000s area. And so that position had remained unfilled for roughly about 12 years. And so considering that, there hadn't been anyone who was providing extension and outreach advisement for how to promote urban agriculture within our region for quite some time. And so bringing someone like myself on, who was more so on the community-based urban agriculture side, is showing just a shift within our University of California institutions. And not even just that, but, you know, sooner rather than later, we're currently hiring for a food sovereignty advisor within Cooperative Extension. And so that just kind of shows how our movement is picking up traction, and that people at the higher levels of decision making are seeing the importance of this movement. And so I'm going to be very excited when that person comes on, because me and that person will be able to collectively work together to increase food sovereignty as well as urban agriculture and improvement in our food systems within the San Diego region.
So for those of us who may not have a close relationship with urban agriculture or food sovereignty, this idea of food sovereignty, can you give us a breakdown of how this new position helps educate folks on not just what what urban agriculture is, but the ways in which we must use urban agriculture and expand our use of urban agriculture in order to reach food sovereignty?
Oh yeah, that's a heavy and loaded question. But yeah, so there are two ways that I think about urban agriculture, and that is kind of in the field of urban agriculture. There's for-profit urban agriculture, which is folks who are growing in an urban environment, and they're growing with the intentions of harvesting, marketing, and selling their products for profit, right? Which is a great idea. Because what really kind of helps there is that those people get to use the land to be able to increase the amount of food that's coming from a localized, even potentially hyper-localized food system. Then on the other side, there's community-based urban agriculture. Community-based urban agriculture oftentimes is subsidized, whether through philanthropic needs or governmental programs. And what the community-based often focuses on is not necessarily the profits that are coming from the growing of food, but oftentimes are focusing on the placemaking, the people organizing, the building power within the people within the communities where this urban agriculture events are happening. And so, you know, what I am trying to do is somewhat bridge those two kind of dichotomies around urban agriculture to kind of help us build the foundations so that way we can begin to continue to support the movement of food sovereignty, where people are having a say in the way that food is being grown, what types of food are growing in their environments, how that food is moving through their communities and being distributed to the people who need it most. So this isn't just necessarily about always on the for-profit side, trying to find the most profitable commodity that I can grow and making sure that that value added is going to the grower. But it's also figuring out how the commodity that's being grown is culturally rich, is connected to the community so that the communities have an appreciation for it. So that way when folks decide to come visit a community garden, to come to a community service day that we often have at Project New Village and at the Mount Hope Community Garden, that it instills something within them that they understand what this place used to be, right? Because we're all on ceded land, right? This is occupied territory. And during that time, and even since its beginnings of occupation, there has been this connection of marginalized individuals who were brought here for a food movement. It's just that this food movement, we need to reconnect with that and take over the power of controlling that movement for our benefits. That's some ways of how I think about the way urban agriculture, food systems, and food sovereignty is brought together.
Ms. Moss, I didn't know if you wanted to add to that, but I have questions obviously for you if you didn't want to add to that.
To add, he said it all. Ask
So, with everything that Dr. Derek said, in what ways is Project New Village creating space for the conversation around urban agriculture, right? For the conversation around gaining more control, more agency over both the production, the distribution, and the consumption of fruits and food that is grown.
Okay. So my background here is to come as a connector or a community organizer. So the space where we're doing this is Southeastern San Diego, or something we call the Good Food District. We coined this term. It was a series of meetings, right? We know we need to do something with good food, and it's in a geographically defined space. It's Southeastern San Diego, Lemon Grove, Barrio Logan, and National City. And we call this the Good Food District. So within this Good Food District, our defined space where we want to see the impact here, we're cultivating community gardens. We currently have one that we've been operating since 2011. Before the end of the year, we'll have four additional gardens. Those gardens are interesting places. We bought this property straight out on Market Street, where the Mount Hope Garden is. But now we have a garden that it's private property, and we're leasing that on Market Street as well. We have a garden in a high school with the culinary program at Morris High School. We have a garden in the office where we are. It's a multiplexed, multi-used. And so it's residents up top and commercial folks on the bottom, but there's two spaces for gardening, and we're working with the children there to put two growing spaces. And then there's a fourth, a church. We have a Seventh-day Adventist church in the area. We look at zip codes. This is a placemaking effort to get to the point where we are creating our own food. In addition to these four gardens, we have 12 backyard growers. By the end of the year, we'll have 15. These are people that backyards range from very small to some people have half an acre in their backyard. This is all an urban setting. Because I wanted it to work, I turned my backyard into a micro. I'm not a grower, I'm an organizer. But as of now, as of June, I am a grower. I have a micro farm in my backyard with about 20 some odd trees and beds, and I'm finding all kinds of things, sharing with my neighbors. But in addition to this growing part of the green part, which we call rooted resources, we're also doing this. We're building, so the property on Market Street, where there's currently a garden, we bought it with the intention of making a food hub. In the food hub, because we know our neighbors, I live in this community, not a lot of people cook food, so we want to put a kitchen so we can show people how to cook food. We want to have a grocery store so these things we're growing has a distribution point. And also there would be a place for another tenant to bring other kinds of value-aligned services into the community. But before we even get to that complex, we also run a mobile farmers market. It's running at about 8 spots every week, somewhere in Southeastern San Diego or within the Good Food District. So we're priming the pump, if you will. We're getting the residents ready to make some behavioral changes that if you choose to shop with us, you're supporting the neighborhood. We are looking at a circular economy here that if you buy from me, I'm going to buy gas and everything else that support this program from other vendors in the neighborhood. We're going to pay the people correctly that grow the food, and we're going to have fair prices. I can't say we're going to have cheap prices. We're going to take all kinds of subsidies, but if I take cheap prices, I'm probably cheating the farmer. If I'm cheating the farmer, in this case, the farmer is us. So no cheating. Everything has to be fair. And getting the mindset that it may not be as convenient as having something delivered or some other thing, but if you participate here, it's helping the overall growth of the community and the health of the people who live here. I hope I answered your question about what are we doing to get ready for food sovereignty at the neighborhood level.
Can I add a little something to that? Just in the idea of the Good Food District, right? Like, that is a rebranding of a community, right? So when I tell people about where this Good Food District is located, the first things they ask me about are like the type of restaurants that might be there, the type of stores that are there. Like they expected the branding to be there because we've already brought the good foods in. And that is the opposite of what this idea of placemaking means. We give it the branding first, so that way people can see that good food piece within their community. They can see now this whole idea of all those things Ms. Moss mentioned, that we have backyard growers, we have actual farmers who are supporting this mobile mobile food market or mobile farmers market. Mm-hmm. And then we figured out a way to bring a food hub, which in a rural setting is usually something that helps farmers be able to bring their harvest in, keep it refrigerated or stored in some type of way to where they can market it in the way that's needed. We're putting all that in a urban core community. And so that is where the food sovereignty piece comes in place. And I just wanted to make sure that we understood all that's happening there, because people may not have seen themselves as, I live in a good food district. I live in a place that can support me with healthy, nutritional, high nutrition foods that come from a hyper local producer. And so I just wanted to add that part to help really bring home what Ms. Moss was saying.
And I think that it's interesting, this idea of urban agriculture for some of us may be very new, right? How many people actually grow either in their backyard, their patio, inside, have plants? Okay. Oh, all right. All right. It's we've started a trend, y'all.
Yeah, I think we have a self-selected group
here,
right?
Yeah, we have a food system.
Great point. Great point. The reason I ask is because the conversation around urban ag isn't always a sophisticated one, right? And so I think one of the concepts that Ms. Moss brought up was this idea that we all want or need affordability, but we all understand the value of supporting the individuals who are in our communities, right? Supporting the individuals who have historically been marginalized. Right. And this is something that does both of those things. The question is, can we do those things and also save money? Right. And if change making is something that we're looking to do, we do have to at some point ask ourselves, what are we willing to commit to that change? Right. What are we willing to put in to that change, to sacrifice for that change? Right. What discomfort can I withstand to make sure that we are creating a better space for everybody? So with that being said, the question that I have for both of you, and Derek, maybe you can take this first, is what is equity in urban ag?
All right. So when we think about equity in urban ag, it's not about... there are a few different ways to think about it. Some people think about it in terms of, I'm building equity the same way I'm building equity in my home. And we are trying to do that with building equity within our community to make sure that the community is gaining wealth in not just monetary wealth, but health wealth, in nutritional wealth, in being able to understand the value that their community has. Then on the other side of equity is we have to think about the institutions that have formed the communities that we live within. Hmm. When we talk about Southeastern San Diego, we're talking about a place that was formed partially through redlining, partially through resources not being allowed to enter those communities to grow the normal type of equity that we might think about when we're talking about financial resources, monetary resources, et cetera. We're talking about, why haven't we had for-profit grocers deciding that they want to develop and occupy the land in that particular community for whatever reasons? And so now we're having an opportunity to ensure that there's increasing amounts of equity through the community organizing and the foundational work that is bringing philanthropic and governmental funds through grants, et cetera, into our community. We're changing the way that money is moving within Southeastern San Diego. If they won't choose to come in and choose to see the value in the dollars that we spend, because all the dollars that we all have are homogenous when we think about how they're, where they come from and the value that they have. But for whatever reason, people don't see that in terms of the traditional forms of capitalism that have caused folks to have to live there and be somewhat not accessing the same resources as people in other places in our region. And so when we're talking about equity, those are the two types of ways that we're trying to rebuild and increase equity within Southeastern San Diego.
I guess on an individual level, one of the things we would do is to make sure that there were subsidies to increase the purchasing power of those who needed it. We've often talked about having time banking, and time banking for us is every, no matter who you are, you put in volunteer time, it's worth a certain value. I don't care if you're an attorney or a janitor. And so with that, you establish an account where you can actually have access to everything that everyone else can at the store. I don't know. So it's just giving a value, if you will, or making it accessible to everyone. And I think in doing that, that has something to do with those who have not gotten before. So addressing this equity concern.
And also the brilliant idea that Project New Village came up with in the community chest, right? Did you want to talk real quickly about that?
Sure. So what we saw, the lessons we're learning from our mobile farmers market is that we have wonderful produce. This is a great vehicle that's out there, but everyone can't afford to buy. And we have the best prices. They compare to anyone in the neighborhood. Sprouts is the, it compares to everyone in our neighborhood. But then people sometimes need help affording what's there. So what we put together is coupons. These coupons say that if you answer surveys about your shopping experience, about your knowledge on nutrition and your desires as a consumer, we'll give you $10 to shop. Well, that $10 that we give has to come from somewhere. It initially started with a grant. The grant ran out. One day we didn't have coupons and there were zero sales at one of our markets. So now we're asking community, if it's important for us to have access to good food and you're one of those people who support even your little league, imagine this is an essential part of living, having access to good food. So consider donating to Project New Village. Every $10 that's donated helps a person have an experience. There's nothing that we take out of that. Literally, it goes to a person to help them buy fruits and vegetables at our farmers market.
Can we talk about the Freedom Farm?
Sure.
Ms. Moss, would you like to introduce the Freedom Farm?
So I'm aware that we're at the San Diego Food System Alliance here and that people have like knowledge of historical things. So the food farm, y'all, right? Y'all know Fannie Lou Hamer. This is our North Star. Started this farm in Mississippi, right? And she started this after her career and dealing with the voting issue in this country and Fannie Lou Hamer's America. But she started the Freedom Farm so that people, poor people in Mississippi, could be in charge of, it's a form, if you will, of sovereignty, getting protein into their diet, right? And then when we started with the protein, then she started doing other things, and then she started putting childcare centers, things because you have the interests and the values of the people who she serves. She did the pig farm first, right? And then after the pig farm, she started the Freedom Farm.
So was the Freedom Farm also the place where she had houses built?
I think there was a housing element out of it. This was a kind of, it was a precursor to us knowing anything about social determinants of health, right? And she was like, to me, addressing all of those in this effort with the Freedom Farms.
So going back to you, Doctor, and your role with the UC system, how do you feel like this role allows you to provide resources, provide knowledge to community? How do you see this role being able to bring back to community?
That's a great question. So there are a few different ways. So a couple of things that I do is I do research, right? I'm a researcher. I'm technically an economist, so I can do all types of quantitative economic analysis to try to help you improve the efficiencies and things like that of any type of agricultural process. Another way is that I try to connect to the other urban agriculture advisors throughout the state. We have several of them. Most recently, I went to a presentation at our Research and Extension Center in Irvine, where an urban agriculture technology advisor was able to provide a presentation around solar voltaics, which is some retractable solar apparatus that you can use to not just produce energy and electricity in a place where you might be somewhat off the grid, or you might want to minimize the amount of cost that you're having to take on in your urban agricultural setting. But it also can provide shading for certain types of plants that might need some amount of shading. It lets through water, so that way if you live in a place where it actually like rains sometimes, that rainwater can be able to make it through. It's not covering up and stopping the natural resource that the earth is trying to provide to us. And so I try to take those different ideas and presentations, because everybody can't make it to that, right? And I then try to extend that information back out to our communities. In other ways that I'm also tasked to help, and just thinking about this idea about the Freedom Farm, there are certain types of legal permitting that the county and certain cities may have around what can be done in urban agriculture. If you have a farm, how many residential housing units and what types of residential housing units can be permitted to be developed in that space. And so I try to extend that information out to folks so that way they can make sure that they're abiding by the regulatory pieces of what's going on. I work with another advisor in our office to make sure that the water components, the water regulations around growing any type of commercial grow that someone might be starting up, that those water regulations are being met. And then also on the other side, trying to do some amount of policy education that could lead to policy advocacy by the community to let them know what types of changes might need to take place. So that way the community stakeholders can see the type of urban agriculture and the type of food systems changes that you all want to see, mm-hmm. right? And so while technically we do not get involved in the university side of things in terms of saying this is what you should do, we can provide education around what are the expected effects of any type of policy that is already in existence. And if you were to make a policy change, these are the different alternatives that you could have, and what would be the anticipated effects of those different types of changes, so that way community folks can know and they can make this, they can make informed decisions around who to show up and talk to, who to pull the levers of power towards to move them to see the changes that you all want to make.
Can we freedom dream for just a second?
Totally.
I would love, just in hearing where you're taking this, Derek, I want to know from both your perspectives, what is an ideal reality in which we utilize urban agriculture to its fullest potential? What does using urban agriculture to its fullest potential look like?
So I'm going to say, I don't know. I'm going to say this. I'm on a journey to see what's possible, right? So I don't know, but I'm ready to try things that are benefit our community in a positive way.
I would say that that's a very good question. And especially in a place like San Diego and San Diego County, where land prices, housing prices are increasing at an exponential rate in comparison to other areas in our nation, in our state. But to dream about what urban agriculture could grow to is this point where there isn't underutilized land, right? Like even just right now, we can think about how could we better use the land that's around us to produce the things we need in terms of, let's just keep it right here at a food conversation, because this is the Food System Alliance annual gathering. How do we make sure that our food is being produced here locally, is culturally significant, And how do we take urban agriculture to be able to do that, to help us with our environmental issues, to help us mitigate climate change by growing using climate smart agricultural technologies and agricultural processes to make sure that the types of things we're growing are using the types of drought tolerance needed for our particular area, that is not needing all the types of transportation systems that we've traditionally used to make sure that we take food that's being grown 400, 500 miles away to bring it here, and that also we don't displace all the other folks who've done that as well. I'm not trying to make it this rural versus urban idea. I want to figure out a way that we can use urban agriculture to complement the rural farmers, so that way we can still see the folks who want to choose that type of lifestyle have, there's a word I'm looking for, but I'm gonna just use autonomy to be able to continue in that. They still have the agency to be able to keep doing what they're doing, as well as building the agency within our urban communities to understand where their food is coming from, what types of foods they want to have, and the significance of the role that they can play in seeing their dreams come true within their communities.
And so I have a question for either the listeners or the attendees. What percentage of your food do you know exactly where it's come from? Right? And should we know where our food comes from? I would say my gut, I'm no expert, but my gut tells me, yes, we might need to. So Ms. Moss, we're going to transition to Q&A, but before we do, I wanted to ask, on this journey of creating space as an organizer, there's been many conversations that you've had with people who were very supportive of the work, but maybe not understanding what the connection to food was. For those who already have a connection to food, right? Can you explain to us why it is that you chose garden spaces as something to proliferate, to create space, to create change?
Okay. So again, I'm an organizer that comes to a space working with my neighbors. So I'm following the footsteps of others. Rich Juarez is not here, but he was a planner in southeastern San Diego. And when we were doing the garden at Mount Hope, the city put a sign up that said for sale. As a community organizer, I started looking for another place to be. As a developer, he said, we got skin in the game. Let's go for this property. Let's compete against the other infill land developers and do what we want to do. Rich passed away in 2019, and that's when we got the money to buy the land. So I'm living on the shoulders, if you will, of others. He and Robert Tambuzzi and Daniel Hernandez and Ronaldo Passano. He was the gatekeeper in Mount Hope. He's the one that said, you can use this property right here, because if he wouldn't have sanctioned it, we probably wouldn't have had a place to land. So I chose it because others chose it, and I'm continuing the work that others, and this is a community engaged process, so I don't make one step without talking to my neighbors. I have a whole complex process for getting input from the neighborhood before we move forward with a step. So nothing happens really fast, because we have to connect with everyone. And I should say, when we first started this work, that's what the folks in the neighborhood said they wanted, a community garden and a farmer's market. Back in 2008, we didn't have that in the neighborhood.
And for those of us who may be very interested in coming to visit the community garden, get involved in some way, what are some of the ways that folks can get involved?
Well, this weekend and every third Saturday, you can come out for community work day. It's about 2 hours. People come from different places, neighborhood folks and others, but it's really kind of a fellowship kind of thing. We come there and everyone leaves smiling. We do pick weeds and we plant things, but we really connect with folks around being outside in nature, and it's a wonderful thing. And the last 2 weeks, we expanded our farmer's market at the Mount Hope Community Garden on Wednesdays. And so now there are other people there that are selling things, people who make products, not food, out of respect for the other folks on the block that sell food. But these folks, they make different products. I had some sea moss the other day that somebody put together. and it's a good place to be. The main thing is the connection with people of I don't know, different kinds of folks. I say I am really proud to be in the do-gooder group, right? People who intentionally try to do good more often than not. I don't care what you look like, you do things. And I like being in that space. So that's my motivation, I think. Be with the do-gooder people. Yeah.
I like that. So obviously we'll be up here if there are any questions that we can't get to. But now we would like to open up the floor. Hey. For Q&A. So I have this snazzy microphone right here that I'm going to walk to anybody who has a question. Does anybody in the crowd have any questions for our speakers today?
Or comments?
It usually just takes one and then everybody has something to say. There we go. Now we're talking. All right, let me mic check. Oh, we're good.
Well, thank you all. My question's actually quite simple. For something like a community day, you know, let's say there's some folks that I work with who live in that community. Maybe they're just interested in that community, but work with like 19,000 people. So I think there's a lot of folks in Southeast. How many folks do you need to come help at a community day? You know, is there too many?
So I don't know that there's been a too many. Probably the largest in our space, and it's not a huge space, but we do, Martin Luther King service, day of service, and our highest number was about 108 people. And these are people that range from 5-year-old people to 85-year-old people. So make do. Thank you.
So I was just wondering if you could repeat your definition of food sovereignty? Because I was writing down the food apartheid and I missed the food sovereignty part.
So I think essentially food sovereignty to me is people who eat the food, benefit from the food, are also the makers of the food, are also the people who make pathways for the food. So it's a shift in the power, if you will, of you're not just a consumer, but you're probably a consumer, a producer, maybe a distributor. So you have an active role in bringing good quality food into your group or neighborhood.
Firstly, thank you for speaking. I'm a student at UC San Diego, so this is all very new to me, and it's really cool to learn about, and I appreciate your efforts. I wanted to learn more about how you guys engage with the community and how you reach out to people who aren't actively involved in the food space. So like people outside of like events like this.
So we intentionally make an effort because not everybody in our neighborhood has access to this digital divide kind of thing. You can't put everything on the internet and figure out that people are going to see it. So we are looking at various ways to go deeper in our neighborhood. So we put out a quarterly newsletter that Anthony, with our community engagement program, we go door to door. We go to different types of events. We invite people in on a weekly. We currently have a crew of AmeriCorps Vistas that are at the garden every day, every weekday. And so when the gates are open, that means anybody can come in, drop in, and help. A lot of times we see that we are in between the 805 freeway and the 15. And sometimes people are on their way to the Costco, and then they discover us. And then what they see is trees sometimes bearing fruit that they can't find culturally in a store. Something about this moringa tree, I don't know, somebody planted one, now we have 8 of them, and people just stop on Market Street when the gate is open. I saw a 78-year-old guy just got up in a tree because he wanted the drumsticks that come from this tree, and it's just the experience of having people connect in the garden. I get to witness it all the time.
And I'll just add that we hope and are somewhat dependent on the range of partners that we have, institutional partners, philanthropic partners, folks who in the spaces of where they work and telling people about this experience that they had in the community service days. Oftentimes there's a business partner who will come, they'll bring some of their workers there who work for that business. The the stories that those people go back and tell, sometimes it's that those in community service is not just weeding or pruning, but there's also oftentimes an art element. So people oftentimes get to come there and like take part in an art project. And so we were just like really dependent on telling that story that way. When I worked at NOAA, some students from UCSD at Scripps did an aquaculture man video. So you can go and search that. And I talked about Project New Village and the work that I was doing in the lens of that I was an aquacultural economist and how I got involved in that. And we went through UCSD's community garden to get the footage for that. So we're really just dependent on people spreading the word because they got an opportunity to go to place. And I saw a hand up over here too, just to also add.
And lastly, I would add, we have a really amazing DJ for our work, our community work day. So the DJ just brings everybody, you know, that's our secret sauce.
This is for Ms. Moss, Carmen Herrera. Would you take beverage donations or compost donations?
We do, and we will. So, yes.
We love compost. Absolutely love it.
That's a way to describe it.
I appreciated Derek's comment about policy and how the youth system can inform policy. What would you say are some of the challenges that in policy to urban agriculture?
Some of the challenges are really, it comes from moving elected officials. You know, like we live in a region that is, I don't want to, divided isn't the type of word that I would like to use, but it has a large variance within our elected official representation. And they don't always see the vision in the same ways. And so really helping people to understand, first off, the importance of urban agriculture and helping the general public understand that if we make some policy changes that could help to increase the amount of urban agriculture that happens in our region, that doesn't mean that goats and chickens and are going to be just running through the streets, going to be running into your backyards. You know, the messaging, getting the messaging out there that urban agriculture can be done in one yard and you could decide to do whatever you wanted to do in your yard, and that everyone should have the power and capacity and bandwidth to do that. And yeah, so those two things I think are kind of some of the bigger policy challenges around getting policy passed that could help to increase urban agriculture. And I see we got two hands, Kathy, and we got a hand here too as well.
I applaud. I've been part of this movement a long time because I adore, I just adore Diane Ross, and learned so much coming in as an active learner to your office on Federal Boulevard and seeing your many offices and different things along the way. So it's wonderful to stay with a movement for a long period of time, I want to say. Because, hey, you meet really cool people, and you get to learn a whole world.
And Kathy?
We've not talked a lot. I mean, we're talking about urban agriculture, but this whole, it's a feel-good factor, too. I mean, we're living, and it's changing the quality of lives. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say, Derek said earlier that we work with partners, so treat them just into the room. They're right over in the corner there. Everything that we're building in southeastern San Diego, we're working with these guys because they have great skills, and they're good folks, so good to see you.
There was a question over here. Oh.
Hello. My question is more so, towards what advice would you give to an organization that's about to step into a community garden and about, like, take over? How would one go about not stepping any toes or, you know, not creating any tension in the community?
So just to make sure I understand, you're asking from the perspective of an organization that's stepping into an existing community garden and you want to make sure the transition is as smooth as possible, not stepping on any toes? Okay. Okay.
I don't know how you don't step on toes. I don't know. I just think of community gardens. They're in a space, so I clearly would involve the people who have interest in the space. If I was an outsider, I would defer to the people who live there and make those connections like first and see what the collective will is to go forward.
And I would just add, you know, coming from a place of like building power and like talking about that at a higher level, you know, oftentimes we talk about community engagement, and I think it's really more about how do you shift from the community engagement paradigm to making it community driven. You can't always not step on toes, but once you get everyone to understand that it's not just, we're not an organization to come in and just take over this community garden, but we are an organization that wants to help put community stakeholders in the driver's seat to lead this movement, be the leaders of this movement, I think that's really important. And there's no easy solution to tell you how to do that, but keeping that as the intention of your community connection will be helpful over the long term to make sure that the movement and folks stay engaged with your community garden space.
All right. We've been asking some great questions. I'm loving them so far. What's going on, y'all? A lot of familiar faces. I love this.
Hi, I'm Christine from Coast Roots Farm, but it has nothing to do with my farm. It's actually a personal thing. So my husband, we actually live right down the street here in Escondido, and my husband has been, we have a wonderful garden. We have lemon trees, so we put them on boxes outside and things like that. We really try to put it out in social media that, you know, if you need something, come let us know. But my husband's very, I'm very proud of him because he wants to start this whole community garden movement. He wants the homes that are able to do it to grow and to provide for those who can't. He's one of those people that wants to put trees on the sidewalks and let people come and pick them, which I'm a huge fan of as well. So if my husband's really trying and he's not getting the excitement that he thought he would. He thought because of COVID, a lot of people started, you know, they started having, you know, having chickens and growing their own community gardens. Is there anything you could tell me so I could pass it on to him to help him start our own little movement? We live in the historic district, and that's where he's really trying to focus starting out because he really wants to provide for those who cannot do it and to also teach them. But at the same time, he just wants to get the word out and get a group together. I don't know if you have any ideas or any insight or any path you could help him with.
I can just merely share my experience was I just work with my neighbors. I started talking with my neighbors and neighbors talked with other neighbors and some of those neighbors work for institutions and then we started doing things. But it was a lot of talking first and really identifying what is our relationship with food and what do we want it to be? What's the gap and then what is it that we can do together? And there's some good people at a county level sometimes that you could work with and they do action planning and things.
I would say one of the reasons why I'm so proud to work with Ms. Moss is because what you're looking at is about 30 years plus of getting after it, right? And so there were iterations of farmers markets, right, where the idea was brilliant. The resources were there temporarily, and it didn't catch fire. People didn't understand the value in it. So there also has to be a larger conversation about what our relationship with food actually is. Perfect event for that, right? And so in that conversation, right, where once we're out of this bubble where everybody is focused on food, right, education is key in that. Right. And identifying the need to change the relationship that we all have with food. The more we value food that comes from the soil, the less we value processed foods, the more things like that will look like, ooh, a tremendous blessing in the community rather than something that can be easily ignored on my way to go pick up my Fritos. Right. So there's multiple layers to that conversation. One of it being you just have to, he has to just continue doing that beautiful work, and people will eventually catch on and catch up. But also that there does have to be a simultaneous conversation about our relationship with the things that we eat. Any other questions? Oh.
And I would just add to that, tell him just keep working his base.
Yeah.
Work his base. They're the people who are a part of it, work those, you know, and stay resilient.
Hi, can you hear me? Okay, thank you so much for this conversation. I hope this question isn't too, I hope this question is relevant for you all, but I was just wondering, for your food hub and market and other endeavors, what's the interface with, if there is any, with public benefits and CalSNAP or SNAP? And if there isn't any, is that intentional?
So all of our food, you can buy with SNAP EBT. We're looking to, the WIC people haven't responded to me this time around. We sold WIC before, but we try to connect to any subsidy program to help people with the purchasing power in our neighborhood. There's a level of poverty there that's serious, and food costs are going up. So a lot of the folks depend on subsidies, and we accept them at our mobile farmers market. Farmers, yeah.
Hi, I just want to echo my gratitude for your stories and your perspectives and your efforts. My question is for Dr. Robinson, and I'm interested in hearing from an economical perspective what you would say to somebody who doesn't think that urban agriculture and people-powered communities can be replicated on a global scale, or they don't see that as ever being successful.
You know, that's a very difficult question to kind of answer, I guess, but we have seen this movement continuously grow over time. We've seen it be successful. And also at the same time, you know, from an organizing standpoint, I don't necessarily try to organize my opposition to move over. I really try to organize my base and the people who are undecided. And so when people feel that way, I don't try to convince them that it can happen. But what I do try to do is find the people who are unsure if it can happen, and help them to understand and see where our vision is and how we're moving it. You know, like, everything is available if you're willing to invest into it, right? So I think that's how I try to, like, go after that from an economical standpoint. And I also then just try to, you know, there, even in the economics community, there are people who don't necessarily believe in non-marketed valuation, right? So, like, there's not people, like, who are buying clean air necessarily. And so people don't think about, well, if you clean the air, it has a market value to having access to clean air or clean water, because there's not someone who's directly saying, I want this pond to be a clean water pond because I'm not necessarily drinking from it, but it has some ecological benefit that I may not necessarily am putting on a market to be able to make it marketable in the way that we standardly think about it. So yeah, I may or may not would necessarily try to convince them. I would just try to reiterate how my beliefs would be in that this movement is happening, it's been growing over years, as we can see how long we've been in this. And then just be like, thank you for your opinion.
Ms. Moss, Dr. Robinson, would either of you guys like to leave any closing remarks on this beautiful gathering?
Well, I invite you to come out to our garden next Thursday, 6:00. We're partying. It's a food justice foray, good food, live music, good people. So show up. Thank you.
I would just second that. If you want to come out, see some of this feel good that Miss Moss was talking about, come out. We'll show you love. I think that's one of our partners. That's been their whole thing, showing love. So you'll feel the love when you get there, and we would love to have you all come down there and really feel and be a part of the movement that we've been working so hard to support in our community. And hopefully you can take that as a seed and spread to your community, whether you're a part of Southeastern San Diego or wherever you are a part of.
In closing, I will say it's going down Thursday, all right? Thursday is happening. We want to see all you beautiful faces there. I don't know if you've ever seen Mount Hope Community Garden, but being there at night when the lights are on, the drinks are pouring, the music is playing, and the food is warm, that's a different vibration. No need to worry about, you know, dressing to the nines. We are still in a garden. So this is a soiree, but you are free to come as you are. We just want to, again, create space with wonderful people. So thank you so much for your time today, y'all. Let's give Miss Moss and Dr. Robinson a big hand. And with that, we are done.